I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire, National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Welcome back. Another candidate is jumping into Arizona's U.S. Senate race to challenge Mark Kelly. Businessman Blake Masters says he, too, will be seeking the GOP nomination. Our political editor, Dennis Welch, is in our newsroom tonight with more on what's becoming a pretty crowded field these days, Dennis.
Yeah, and Masters helps run a capital investment firm as well as a foundation for Peter Thiel. He's a billionaire businessman and what has been described as a Republican mega donor. Thiel is expected to drop millions of dollars on Arizona's high-stakes Senate race next year, which could make him, Mr. Masters, who's very little known in the political world here, a very viable contender.
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. On this edition of the program, I just had to replace our usual intro music with something a little bit more creepy, because we're going to be talking about Peter Thiel, the controversial tech billionaire who infamously backed Trump in the 2016 United States presidential race. As you heard in that clip played right before this intro, Thiel hasn't given up on backing populist, and I use that word in quotation marks, candidates in the Trumpian mold. Like, for example, his collaborator and employee, Blake Masters, run for the Senate in Arizona. And as it turns out, there may be a material incentive for Thiel to support Masters' campaign, namely the ways in which it could benefit Thiel's border security and weapons investments. Joining us to discuss that is Eli Clifton, a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute and an investigative reporter for that institute's premier magazine, Responsible Statecraft. As a launching point for our conversation, we'll be discussing his latest article, Meet Peter Thiel's Military-Industrial Candidate. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And with all that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Eli Clifton of the Quincy Institute. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I've been wanting to have on the show for a while now. I became familiar with his work through Ben Freeman of the Center for International Policy, Eli Clifton of the Quincy Institute, and the investigative journalist extraordinaire for the Quincy Institute's Responsible Statecraft magazine. How are you doing today, Eli?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to have you on to talk about Peter Thiel's military-industrial candidate in Arizona. But first, we have some news that broke recently about Tom Barrack and U.S. foreign policy with regards to the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. What do you make of all that?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly a couple strands here that jump out at me. First of all, it's highly unusual to see an actual real life prosecution of somebody for being a unregistered foreign agent. And I say that, and you mentioned Ben Freeman earlier on, but Ben and I are what's known as FARA nerds, which is the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And there's probably about two FARA nerds in the entire world. It's not a very popular statute. It's not something that there's very many prosecutions around, but it's a very interesting law. And it's one that basically means that if you are acting as an agent of a foreign principal, the foreign principal doesn't even need to be a government, just a foreign principal, and your actions are to effectively influence the public discourse or U.S. policy, that you need to disclose that. That's all. That you need to file registration saying, hey, here's what I'm doing. And a lot of folks, in my belief, are probably have run afoul of that. In fairness, there's plenty of folks that are lobbyists and that work in communications who do file under FARA. But it's really interesting to see somebody really where the core of the indictment. I mean, they had him for lying to federal agents, and it certainly seemed like he did that as well. But it seemed like the core of this was that he was acting as an unregistered foreign agent for the UAE. And then we move on to sort of, well, what's so interesting about that in particular? Well, first of all, the UAE is generally perceived, in, at least inside Washington, D.C., and outside the Beltway, I think perceptions are different, but in D.C., as a country that's very friendly to the United States. You know, their ambassador is probably one of the most popular ambassadors in Washington, Yusuf Al-Otaiba. They fund a large number of think tanks in Washington, if not the majority. And it's considered to be a safe country to take money from, to do business with, for folks in Washington to have their research funded by. And it's pretty interesting to see that, hey, Thomas Barak just got indicted for being an unregistered foreign agent for UAE. Now, this shouldn't be a surprise. This was reported at least 3 years ago, pretty much everything that was in that indictment. And I think there was clearly some timing here that they didn't want to go forward with this prosecution, perhaps during the Trump administration. But this certainly does start to pull out a very interesting thread here, which is, you know, there was a lot of attention on the potential that Russia could have had some degree of leverage or influence over Donald Trump and the people in his orbit. But as it turns out, in this prosecution, we're seeing that it was actually a country that the U.S. is generally doesn't look at as having being a foreign malign influence in U.S. foreign policy. But we see up close in this indictment, and I encourage you and everyone else to read this indictment. It's really interesting because they lay out and over the course of about 40 pages how it was that the United Arab Emirates essentially ended up being able to insert things into Donald Trump's speeches.
So one more thing with regards to FARA and this issue of foreign influence, and then we'll move on to Blake Masters and Peter Tilpit. Do you ever find it difficult to talk about this issue of foreign influence? Because I find that, for instance, if I criticize U.S. relations with, say, Modi and India, I'll get accused of being Hindu-phobic. Or if I criticize the U.S. and Saudi Arabia relationship, Saudi-phobic. How do we talk about these issues without, I guess, crossing the line into, you know, racism or being accused of racism?
I think that's a really important question. And I'm going to, and again, I'm going to sort of plagiarize from Ben Freeman here, who has really always has a good response to that, which is that, you know, FARA is not a scarlet letter. FARA is very often talked about in, you know, when people are talking about their fear of a specific country and say, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of unregistered foreign agents that need to file under FARA for China or Russia or Saudi Arabia or what have you. And that's fine. You know, they can hold those views. The statute itself says nothing about specific countries. It's agnostic to that. It just says it could be any foreign country. It could be Canada or Mexico. And there are registered foreign agents, I believe, for both Canada and Mexico. It's not, it shouldn't be a shameful thing to file under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. The fact that there are unregistered foreign agents, at least now according to the Justice Department, is it should be a point of concern. And I think it's kind of sidestepping the issue generally to say, oh, well, that just shows that you're bigoted against X or Y country. No, what you're really saying is that Americans who act as foreign agents should be disclosing it regardless of what country it is. There shouldn't be a get out of jail free card because it's a friendly country in subjective of one person's eyes versus another. The point is, hey, maybe you should conform to that statute. I don't think that that's too radical of an idea, but I understand what you're saying. I think it very often gets derailed into this thing about, oh, well, you know, you're being Hindu-phobic, you're being Islamophobic, you're being what have you. No, this is something where we just would like to see the statute get enforced or the Justice Department, you know, put out new guidance about it that's different than what it is. Right now, there's a huge gap between what that statute requires and what people are doing, especially in Washington, D.C.
And I was just going to add to that. I think it's, you know, something the American citizens, voters have a right to know about, you know, because different lobbies are, you know, always giving money to different candidates. And that sort of leads us into Peter Thiel's military industrial candidate. And I guess I want to stop right there. You know, Peter Thiel is known as Mr. Big Tech and PayPal and all this other stuff, floating islands people have talked about. But putting all that aside, what does Peter Thiel have to do with foreign policy? Where's the connection there?
Well, Peter Thiel has some very significant investments in firms such as Palantir and Anduril that have enormous contracts with the federal government, with the Department of Defense, I believe in both of those cases, as well as for doing border security work. And as a result, these companies probably, we don't know exactly, but a significant portion of their revenues come from these government contracts. Now, that's kind of interesting for a guy who, you know, you said you think of it as Mr. Big Tech, and I think that's kind of funny because I can't get actually a strong sense of what it is that Peter Thiel does believe or does stand for. What I do see is that he seems to represent a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So he's Mr. Big Tech to a lot of people because he's, and I think that's a justifiable way to portray him given his long track record of investing in and helping to start up some huge tech companies. But he also is now backing political candidates who are huge critics of big tech, such as Blake Masters and J.D. Vance. And when you even talk about what his political beliefs are, you know, I was just looking up on Wikipedia, how is he characterized? And they say, well, he's a self-described conservative libertarian. He's been espousing support for national conservatism, and he has criticized economic libertarian attitudes toward free trade and big tech. Well, that's a mouthful. And I think that the thing that maybe, I'm not saying it's possible, but he has components of all of those in his activism and his political beliefs. But it seems like maybe the thing that we haven't been looking at or talking about so much is the fact that maybe Peter Thiel is also motivated in his political activity and political giving by his own profit. And it seems like in this case, he's now made two very splashy political contributions of $10 million each, way, way, way early in the political cycle. We're sitting here in, what, July of 2021, and it's over a year until the midterm elections, and he just dropped $10 million on Blake Masters and on J.D. Vance. And it doesn't seem like a huge coincidence that when you start to look at what these guys are talking about, specifically Blake Masters, hey, it's maybe these are all things that Peter Thiel happens to believe, but it also happens to be things that are really good for his biggest investments.
Now, you know, just to clarify for people, if you're wondering why the name J.D. Vance is familiar, that's because he made a huge splash with his book, Hillbilly Elegy. And it's very interesting because he seems to have gone from being, you know, relatively anti-Trump to sort of maybe trying to cater or pander to the pro-Trump audience. Blake Masters, people may know a little bit less about, though, and he actually works for Peter Thiel, right?
That's right. He's worked for him for many years. He actually holds a couple of leadership roles with Thiel. He's the chief operating officer of Thiel Capital. And he helps run the Thiel Foundation, which is Peter Thiel's philanthropic organization. And as his role at Thiel Capital, you better believe that Blake Masters has a pretty good sense of where the financial interests for his employer lie. It wouldn't be a huge stretch to assume that even Blake Masters may be personally invested in this as well. And his campaign website, you know, prominently discloses this fact. You know, this is considered to show that he has the necessary experience. But it's a really closed feedback loop, it seems like, because then he's openly talking again. His leading issues were border security and talking about the threat from China. All things that Thiel's investments, again, overseen by Blake Masters in both Anduril and Palantir, would have huge financial incentives to help promote those components of U.S. policy. Anduril is the guy behind it. Palmer Luckey has really been a vocal person talking about the threat posed by China, specifically in AI. And certainly Anduril and Palantir have both benefited from the Trump border policies. As a matter of fact, Blake Masters put up on his Twitter account that he's him posing in front of the border wall saying how impressive it is. And his website talks about that they need more of sort of the high-tech border security measures, exactly the type that Palantir or Anduril can provide and have provided.
Now, What I find interesting too is I feel like a lot of these types of candidates, they may say things about, oh, we shouldn't be spending money on, you know, wars that, you know, we don't need to spend money on. You know, they may make criticisms, for instance, of the forever wars. But when it comes to China, they're extremely hawkish. And I think sometimes people miss that.
Yeah, it's the big exception, right? That and I think it has a bit to do with, again, I can't explain what might be the sort of the policy or political underpinnings of some of this. But I do think there is this quality that the forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have become incredibly unpopular. And that's why you see that there was public support for Trump's announcement of pulling troops out of Afghanistan. And there has been public support for Biden's actual going through with the troop withdrawal. It seems like this is something that generally the American public is supportive of. You know, two decades of war in these places, people are sick of it. I think with China, first of all, it's not a hot war. People don't see it imminently becoming one necessarily. And there is, it's very easy to fearmonger about it. And I think that that is something that Peter Thiel and the companies that he has invested in have done so with a considerable profit motive. I'm not saying that's the thing driving them, but that motivation is clearly there when you look at what their contracts are for, you know, and the type of business they are trying to get into. And I think especially in terms of AI, in terms of some of these newer technologies and the longstanding relationship between Silicon Valley and the Department of Defense, Silicon Valley see those that want to do business with the DoD, which is maybe a small, shrinking number of them, but those that do see China in competition with China as their key to getting those contracts.
And I was going to say, so much of this seems very out in the open. I mean, when we look at Masters' campaign website, he's very much part of this whole push to completely end illegal immigration using every tool at hand. And one of the things I noticed on the website when he writes that is he mentions surveillance technology. So, I mean, there you go back to Till and things like Palantir. So, you know, there's definitely interests at stake here.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there is this very sort of sick irony that a lot of what they and a lot of the, you know, accurate fears, perhaps well justified about Chinese technology and the export of it has to do with their ability to surveil not just their own populations, but potentially abroad as well. Engage in industrial espionage, engage in state level espionage, access to all sorts of technology that maybe we don't want them to have immediate access to or information. And it's kind of bizarre that that some of the companies that have been promoting those, pushing those fears are actively developing technology that can be used to surveil people. It's nearly like it's a competition between surveillance technologies. It's not so much saying that that technology itself can be problematic when it's put in the hands of the state.
And I was just going to add with the immigration thing, I mean, I think Palantir Technologies actually has ongoing contracts with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
They sure do. They've denied that they were involved in the past with, was it the child separation policies, but then there was evidence that indeed they were involved in that.
So you also mentioned a company, Anduril. Could you tell us a little bit more about that company? Because they play a big role in this article, and I just want listeners to get a feel for what that is and get it in their head to think about that.
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting company in that they've really active. The guy, I mentioned him earlier, Palmer Luckey, he's been really heavily focused on securing contracts with DOD. And I mentioned earlier also that, you know, I think there's a shrinking number of tech companies that are comfortable doing DOD contract work. And he's actually not just said that they're actively seeking these Defense Department contracts, and indeed they've gotten them. But he's also an open critic of tech companies who have been wary of taking these. And he's saying, you know, that that's wrong and that this is the right thing to do. And I think it's pretty clear this is a core piece of their business. Now, they've developed some drones. They've developed, some border security measures. And it certainly, when you look at their products, even their augmented reality and VR products, it's all geared towards, it seems like contracts with the U.S. government, potentially other governments as well. And that's I think a noticeable part of their business that doesn't get talked about as much. Now he's the type of things he will talk about is exactly sort of access to information, the fact that the Chinese can He tries to portray it. He's a conspiratorial guy. He even portrays it as that the Chinese have effectively subverted American democracy by investing in our companies and by making it so employees at tech companies don't want their companies doing DoD contracts. So it all becomes this like this loop that goes back to him trying to get these DoD contracts, defending it vocally, and in the process making himself very wealthy. And he already is very wealthy. He's worth close to $1 billion, thanks to the sale of his VR technology to Facebook. Young guy, less than 30 years old.
Yeah, I was going to say, Lucky's comments about, you know, they don't even have to come after us militarily. They could just invest in our companies. And it all seems like a sales pitch for getting DoD contracts for his company, you know?
It is. And again, I find it kind of interesting that I think we generally want to give people the benefit of the doubt. We want to try to sort of explain their political beliefs through, you know, sort of their rational thought rooted in some, you know, that we all have these shared interests of, you know, maybe U.S. national security or something. And maybe that's true. But I think we should at least consider the possibility that some of these people are saying these things because it is paying them very, very well. And in the case of Palmer Luckey and in the case of Blake Masters, their livelihoods have been linked to hyping these threats and trying to secure DOD and U.S. government contracts for companies they started or companies that they are invested in.
So the bottom line when it comes to, say, Masters and foreign policy is basically promote this idea of, well, the American people are sick of these pointless interventions abroad. But, you know, with the exception of we have to deal with the U.S.-Mexico border and we have to deal with Beijing, they're big problems. And they just happen to incidentally help the companies I'm either involved with or have been involved with in the past.
Exactly. And I get to use this to push back on the critics in the tech sector, maybe their own colleagues, who say you shouldn't be doing these contracts with the government.
Why is there it? So why would there be pushback against that with regards to people within this sort of Silicon Valley world? Like, why don't they want these contracts?
Well, I think that, you know, Silicon Valley is kind of fascinating because, you know, there are, we so often look at Silicon Valley as being, you know, I think people like Steve Jobs kind of promoted this image of the history of Silicon Valley being sort of very tied in with counterculture, with coming out of the 60s and 70s. And sort of some high-minded ideals, and that tied to universities. So, you know, of sort of research for the sake of, you know, betterment of society. And there certainly is that strong history there. That's not to be ignored. The thing that we don't look at so often is that there was also a incredibly long history of Silicon Valley and the tech sector's ties to the weapons industry and to directly to DOD and the U.S. government. And to, for that matter, the intelligence services as well. And I think that now we're starting to see in a more public manner that clash. That I think it was, what was it, Google or Facebook employees, maybe both, were speaking out about U.S. government contracts, saying that they were concerned about that, specifically DOD-related or surveillance-related contracts. And I think on the other side, you're now seeing people like Peter Thiel talk more openly, as well as the people he's invested in, like Palmer Luckey, about the defending that relationship. But even acknowledging that it exists in public, I think is a relatively new phenomenon. It was never a top secret classified thing, but it was something that wasn't talked about so much because we kind of liked this idea, I think, at a cultural level of sort of these, you know, hippies and nerds who came together to change the world. But there were some other interests and components in there as well. And they've all maybe coexisted a little better until more recently. And I think the fact that, you know, that you have Palmer Luckey coming out swinging at other tech companies and tech employees who have opposed their company's DoD contracts is, you know, a sign of some sort of changing times, or at least the debate kind of breaking out into the open.
There were just maybe two more things I wanted to mention. First, it's interesting, you know, a lot of conservatives have started talking about the NSA recently because of the Tucker Carlson allegations that he was being spied on by the NSA. But a lot of people forget about, you know, the private sector and how companies like Palantir can be, you know, just as dangerous in terms of surveillance. Is that something people should consider when looking at Peter Thiel, surveillance technology, and the candidates he's funding?
You know, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I think that, you know, I think thus far, again, like there's these inconsistencies here, right? Which is that, you know, libertarians like Peter Thiel have typically been some of the more vocal critics of the NSA. And I think, you know, Glenn Greenwald is probably a good example of that. And now sort of Tucker Carlson, you know, and I think sort of libertarian views have this way of sort of dipping in and out of the conservative discourse and popular culture at various times. The NSA sort of coming into it now, I think that it was sort of primed for that with 4 years of Trump saying that the deep state and the intelligence services were out to get him. And I think even at that point, there was a weird inconsistency with Peter Thiel being clearly a Trump supporter and very much interested in doing business with the NSA and get those contracts that involve large-scale surveillance. So I think that that inconsistency has been there. Thiel doing this and Tucker Carlson, sort of two popular strains of the Republican Party. My sense is that Thiel's defense and Palmer Luckey's defense of working with intelligence services, working with DOD, is something that kind of stays in a rather narrow space. The truth is that these inconsistencies haven't been called out that much. I think they're about to be more so because of the fact that now Thiel had made these big investments into J.D. Vance and Blake Masters. So now it's sort of breaking into the national stage, as well as sort of what views do these people hold, what things have they said, and where have they put their money. And I think that inconsistency is something that perhaps we're going to start to get called out on. I don't think it's been a problem until maybe now. They've just happily coexisted in this, maybe it's sort of doublespeak world. I don't know if that really answers your question, what you're trying to get at, but I think there is kind of an intriguing, you know, duality here of that one level, yes, the NSA is scary, at the same time we want to do business with it.
No, I guess my thing was, I think there's legit concerns about state surveillance programs and whatnot, but I think people should also consider, especially with this Pegasus spyware scandal, you know, the private sector can be involved in surveillance too.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I think that, you know, I think Palantir is a good example. I think Pegasus is a good example of, let's be honest, this is not black and white. This is not private sector, public sector. This is some blurry in between. And that might be truly the most dangerous concoction you can come up with, in that it's a little unclear who controlled this technology at what points in time, who made the decisions to share it with other countries at given points in time. And the motivations for doing so may have been political and they may have been profit driven. And I think that when you start to enter into that space, it's a very slippery slope and it's dangerous. And it's hard to disaggregate exactly what happened and what safeguards are in place, because pretty much every party involved in it is now motivated to strip back safeguards.
Well, there's also the whole, I mean, I think we have an issue of revolving doors between the private sector and the public sector, the defense, you know, sector. So there's that. But in regards to Peter Thiel's funding of Vance and then Blake Masters, how much coverage has there been of this? Do you think there's going to be more coverage of it going forward? I know you covered it in Responsible Statecraft. I think it's also been covered in The American Prospect. Yeah. Do you think that there's going to be a lot of media pressure about this issue?
You know, I think there will be some attention on it. I see it going two ways. One is that Thiel was really smart to have done it now. So no one's really paying attention to the midterms. You know, we're a year and 4 months out. So, okay, fine. You want to have a scandal about it right now. It's quite possible that it'll blow over and it just won't be, there won't be oxygen for it in a year's time. The other possibility is that it's kind of a slow drip and that, you know, that Blake Masters and J.D. Vance's opponents decide to start talking about it. And I really think the determinant here isn't going to be national publications or those that aren't based in Ohio or in Arizona. It, like Responsible Statecraft or The American Prospect, but local media in these states. And I think that's the really interesting question here is, well, what does local media do with this? And when do they choose to start picking up on it and reporting it? I think a little bit of that has happened already in Arizona. But to me, that's the big question. Of course, that gets us into questions about sort of the state of local media, which is that it's dying. But in this case, it will be really interesting if this became actually an issue that people were talking about in these states when we're getting closer to the election. But it's very hard to tell right now. And again, it's unusual to have such large political contributions happen in a year and 4 months before an election. It's unusual, especially that it's a controversial contribution. And I think there probably was some sense to, honestly, to I would tilt slightly towards saying that if you were going to do it, now is probably the best time to do it. Make it happen, deal with the media hit, and hope that you can be talking about something else in a year.
Now, I always like to ask as a final question, there's going to be some naysayer out there that'll say, well, you know, he's just making a contribution. He's allowed to do that. It's free country, which is true. I agree. But why should maybe American citizens be concerned about a figure like Peter Thiel funding political candidates? What's the real issue for the average American voter at stake here?
I think the thing that's concerning about the appearance of this is that there is a potential because of the large sums of money that Peter Thiel just gave to these candidates. And in the case of Blake Masters' longtime financial ties to Peter Thiel and professional ties, he basically built his career for him. Peter Thiel built Blake Masters' career, that they will be highly responsive to Thiel's needs if they are elected to the Senate. And that would include, in this case, the fact that Thiel's financial and political needs include needing to get these contracts. So having politicians who are indebted to you for their political, if not their professional careers as well, in a position in which they could perhaps help influence policy decisions that could be hugely beneficial to you means that it raises the question of who exactly are these candidates working for? Are they working for their constituents who elected them? Or are they working for a billionaire who doesn't even live in either of the states that these candidates are in? And that's where it starts to look weird. If you have an outside funder, doesn't live in either of these states, backing candidates who are saying things that happen to be pretty good for this funder's business interests, and it starts to raise the question of, well, what about the people who are actually the constituents or would be constituents of these politicians? Are they being represented or not?
What was that last part?
Are they being represented? Are the constituents being represented? Or is it Peter Thiel who's being represented?
And for me, that's the crux of the issue, because I mean, you know, these candidates like J.D. Vance and Blake Masters, I think they want to present themselves as, well, we're the populace, we're for the people. But at the same time, it seems like they have a, you know, interests at stake with the people funding them.
Exactly. I mean, they're running on being populist candidates in both cases. And it seems like that's inconsistent with at least where they both just got $10 million from.
And also, just to reiterate, what should the concerns be for Americans when it comes to the U.S.-Mexico border and U.S.-China relations when it comes to, say, a candidate like Blake Masters?
Yeah. I mean, listen, the increasing militarization of the border is a huge, huge, huge cash cow for companies like those that Blake Masters and Peter Thiel have invested in. And the question of how effective these technologies are, whether it really gets to the root causes of why there is a so-called immigration crisis, is sort of being lost in the mix here.
Why is it a waste of taxpayer money?
Absolutely, it's a waste of taxpayer money, and you're trying to solve a problem that you're not going to solve through these contractors, and you're not addressing perhaps what are the root causes of people wanting to come across that border. Which you can't just say the solution is a bigger wall, when perhaps the problem has to do with, you know, just to speculate here, but the war on drugs, the fact that the United States has been a destabilizing influence in Central and South America. And hasn't been a very good partner to many of those countries or the people that live in them. With China, I think the stakes are perhaps even higher. If we want to combat climate change, we have to work with China. If we cannot reach an agreement with China about reducing carbon emissions, there's nothing that really the rest of the world can do that will be able to even start to turn the tide on this. It's really important that we figure out a way to coexist with China and to deal with our shared interests and problems. We're not going to make China into the liberal democracy that it seems like a lot of China hawks want it to be. What we can do is try to have a relationship where we can influence them in areas where we may actually be able to a little bit, which is around maybe perhaps around climate, and in productive ways engage with them on issues like human rights. But making this an all-on Cold War style competition with China basically means that everything else that isn't immediately security related in that military competition goes onto the back burner. I can't think of many cases of where countries have had Cold War style militarized competition and have been able to engage on issues of any other issues, be it shared threats like climate change or areas like human rights. This is not something that happens. You simply, those things get subjugated to the back burner. So if we care about those issues in a meaningful way and we don't want to just posture, we need to think about how we're going to try to coexist.
I just wanted to add one more thing to that with regards to the US and China. I think too, now people don't mistake what I'm saying here. You know, I'm not saying we would end up in some World War III situation with China, but when it comes to geopolitics, you know, one false move can lead to really unpredictable escalations and consequences. And I think we have to be very careful, especially as we enter into what seems like a new Cold War, to be very smart about how we handle our relations with China. You know, diplomacy is very, very important, I guess is what I'm getting at. And we don't want to make a horrible mistake because we were too hawkish about something, for instance, on the South China Sea or, you know, in some other area.
And again, when you militarize that relationship, when you make it all about effectively military competition, whether you intended to or not, diplomacy is now deprioritized. It makes less space for that. And we don't always see that as a direct trade-off. That's not the way that China hawks like to talk about it. But I think it's really important that we see it that way, because this is a real trade-off that we're engaged in here. This is a real trade-off that these people are pushing on us, that people like Blake Masters and Peter Thiel are trying to make part of the popular political discourse. But they're not talking about the fact that it's a trade-off. They talk about it as only that, oh, we need to have this competition with China. We need to push back against China. They're not talking about what we lose if we go down that path.
Well, and there's so many assumptions that they make in the process. The idea that, you know, China is going to be the new global super police force. And we don't know that for sure, actually. So they have a lot of assumptions and there's a lot of dangers involved with all of this. Anything else you wanted to add in closing or how my listeners can keep up with your work?
You know, this has been a fantastic conversation. You can keep up with my work at responsiblestatecraft.org. Please check it out. We publish a lot of other great people there as well. And I just got to make a pitch for my narrow area of reporting, which is that I think it's a really overlooked thing, that intersection of money and politics and U.S. foreign policy. Money and politics is something we do a lot of reporting and talking about. Foreign policy very often is somehow seen as in another world. But you know what? It's part of the American political process. And there's special interests, some are foreign, some are domestic, who want to impact it in ways that will impact all of our lives. So we should pay attention.
I just wanted to add one thing to that, and I think it's really important for people to understand. I always hear people talk about Soros is funding this or Koch is funding this. People never talk, in my experience, enough about, you know, the defense industry and the amount of money they put into things. And when I look at that, sometimes it appears, you know, the Kochs and the Soroses of the world can be small fries compared to some of the defense industry people.
That's absolutely right. And in interest of full disclosure, the Quincy Institute has funding from both Soros and Koch, which is a lot of fun to watch what it does to people who are conspiracy minded.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Eli Clifton. Be sure to check out his work at the Quincy Institute and Responsible Statecraft magazine. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter @ views parallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Brian, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.